You're listening to DottoTech, helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, at home, at school, or at work. Brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. 20 years, the trusted voice of technology in Canada, Steve Dotto.
Hello and welcome to DottoTech. I'm Steve Dotto, and we are glad you're joining us today. Art Factora, what were you doing January 5th, 1984?
I was learning my times tables, I believe. Probably wiping peanut butter off my face.
You didn't watch the Super Bowl that day, did you?
I don't think so.
Okay, that was the legendary.
Was that the Dwight Clark?
Why 1984 will not be night like 1984 ad from Apple at halftime of the Super Bowl. I think it was Pittsburgh Steelers, and I can't remember who. I have to look up that up. Maybe we can look that up at the break. But it is now 30 years since that ad launched the Mac, and for me personally, the Mac has it's been the one consistent in my life. It has since almost that day. I've built a career around that computer and other computers like it, but it really opened the doors and it changed the world. And
are you trying to say it's the only like relationship that you've maintained in that period of time?
It's about as tumultuous as a real relationship too. There's
but
been
it's
love,
stuck
there's
around,
been hate, there's
right?
Been,
it wants to see the end with you.
I guess it does. Well, there's one sitting in front of me right now, but it looks a lot different. I'm looking at the magazine for Macworld issue. Premier issue with Steve Jobs leaning on the Macintosh, the 128K Macintosh, 128K. That was the total memory in the thing. We've got graphic logos on our website that are larger than that. Word processing documents are larger than that. That was the whole thing. And we had an operating system. We had a word processor. We had a graphics package. We had everything. Yeah, in 128K. And I think it was probably, well, we'll talk price in a little bit, but it was deeply expensive. It was hideously expensive back in the day.
I do remember my first Mac experience. I had a teacher, I believe. It was probably grade 6. So it was probably like 1986, 87. And he was big into computers. He was one of those guys who thought it was the future, and I guess he was right. And he brought it in, and it just looked so much different than the other computers.
It was completely different.
Yeah.
It was revolutionary.
Absolutely. Like, it was just one box, and then the floppy disks went inside.
And it had a personality.
It did.
You know, I was watching Despicable Me, and you know the Minions?
Yeah.
They look like Macs. That's why they're so appealing. They look like a little Mac. Especially, is it Kevin, the one with one eye? He looks just like a Mac.
Huh.
Just a slightly. You never thought of that, did you?
No, now I will.
Very
I'll
cute
have to
and cuddly.
It.
You know, it was. So today's show is dedicated to kind of a Mac retrospective. We're gonna be joined momentarily by some of the guys that were there at the beginning with me, because this is my journey as well as Apple's journey. And I do. And people around the Mac feel very personally connected to it, because as you'll learn from listening to us, I think the Mac for us was kind of like flower power was for the young folk in the 60s and that sort of thing. It was an empowerment. It was the future, and it was our chance to make a difference in the world. And the Mac was the tool that we could do that with. And it did. It was, I don't mean to kind of be too, you know, philosophical about it, but it was a profound change, and it was a profound key in most of our careers. So we're gonna be chatting about that.
So even back then, did you guys like as a whole, you obviously believed in it, but did you think that the long term? Did you see the long term picture, or did you just? I mean, obviously you were 30 years younger, and you wanted a job, and this was exciting. But did you see? Did any of you expect to see what we have today?
You know, yes and no. Here's the deal. There was a video in about 1988, which we'll talk about in a minute. I know when Ian Selby joins us that this was a video that he would show all the time. It was called Knowledge Navigator. And it was after Steve Jobs had left Apple. And so it wasn't at the genesis. It wasn't at the beginning, but it was just after that. And it was during the John Sculley era. And there was a video called Knowledge Navigator, which an awful lot of the technology that we're using today was showcased as technology of the future. And I don't know if I believed it, but I really liked what I saw. It It was very cool. There was voice recognition. There was data amalgamation. There was touch and gesture recognition, all built into this video called the Knowledge Navigator. And if you look on YouTube and watch it, it is a peek at the future. You know, there's a couple of those things, but that one was the one I'm sure that the guys will talk about when we get into that. Personally, I was so busy learning about what we had at the time that I didn't have time to look too far. You know, I was more excited about what was coming down 2, 3, 4 months down the line, which was already it seemed like every cycle, every 4-month cycle, we were coming up with a new app, a new way to do things, a new industry that we were suddenly going to impact. So we were on a roller coaster of change and excitement, because there was just so many new areas that were being opened up because of this one little box, because of this one little piece of technology. It's pretty way cool. We should probably take a break and then we'll return with the guys. That's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break and you're going to return with more a look back 30 years of Mac this week on Dottotech.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better. Nobody does it better except maybe you.
Today, a very special Dottotech. It is a 30-year retrospective of the Mac. January 5th. I believe I got the date right. Oh, the Wayback Music. It's like we're doing Wayne's World. Awesome.
Only with a real sound effect this time.
Do you even know what Wayne's World is, Art?
I'm not that young.
Okay. My kids don't. What are you talking about, Dad? We're 30 years of the Mac. 30 years ago, in 1984, Apple told the world why 1984 will not be like 1984. They were referring, of course, to George Orwell's vision of the future. But that was the launch of the Mac, and it has for a lot of us changed our lives. So I've invited a couple of guests. We might have one joining us by phone in a little while, but joining me in studio now, two old colleagues of mine, colleagues, competitors that I've worked with for many years. I've got Kevin Jampol joining us. Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm good, Steve. Happy to be here.
Now, in 1985 or so, you were a salesperson at Byte Computers, a legendary Vancouver-based Mac dealership,
That's right.
And were you just like sales chimp? Did you have any specialty? Were you just like fresh out of school and just needed a job?
I think back then, anybody who could turn on a computer and understand it was a sales chimp.
Yeah. And it was fun. It was because every day we were learning something new.
Well, it was. I mean, I got into computers about 1978, 1980, back with Radio Shack and then Byte Shop after that, and working with Apple IIs prior to the Macintosh. So what happened in 1984, changed the way you sell, changed the way we use computers, we changed people's lives.
Yeah, that was the excitement of it. Also joining us here, Ian Selby. Now, Ian was because I worked at another dealership, he was our Apple rep for many, many years. And his job, as far as I recall, was to do as little as possible to still gather the check. But Ian, now when did you join Apple, Ian?
I'm glad you learned something, Steve, from that wise old advice I gave you 30 years ago, it must be.
I'll never forget. I had just joined another dealership, and we had a presentation at Apple, and they were showing us some stuff, and so I had a question about it. So I phoned Ian. I can still remember it. And Ian, on the other, he actually dressed me down. He didn't know, we weren't friends at that point or anything. I was just another sales guy. And he says, "Don't you ever tell anybody that I'm helping you. This is not my job." Because he didn't want to do too much of that, actually understanding the product.
I didn't want you to think you could lean on me for technical support, Steve.
Oh, lean on you for technical support. That is priceless. So when did you join Apple, Ian?
I joined Apple in October 1984.
Okay.
So it was like 9 months after the ad you're talking about that ran. Mm-hmm. My first ever look at the Mac was when I walked into the Byte Shop, John and Don McKay, many, many moons ago. And the young man sitting next to me, Kevin Jampol, gave me a demo of the Mac.
Okay. Now, you were at Xerox before, right? Or no, was it Olivetti?
No, the Italian technology company. Olivetti.
Yeah, so you were selling smart typewriters.
Smart typewriters, door-to-door. In fact, CL Radio Station was a client I called on. That's a whole other show and another topic for another day, perhaps.
Okay.
But this was my old patch, selling door-to-door, yes.
Cool. So Kevin actually demoed the Mac for you the first time you saw it.
And I couldn't believe it. And I was used to, like CPM as an operating system with a green screen or an orange screen and a C colon and backslashes, all kinds of strange gibberish. And Kevin showed me this thing, Mac Draw and Mac Paint and Mac Write. And I started to draw. This is the computer for everyone else.
And that was the three apps that shipped with it. It was Mac That's Draw, right. which was a object-oriented drawing program.
Right.
Mac Paint, which was a simple painting program. And remember, the Mac was a monochrome monitor, so we could only paint in black and white, but just putting pixels in. It was 72 dots per inch was the That's screen it. Resolution.
Right.
What was the size of that screen? It was an 8 inches by 6 inches, 8 inches by 7 inches.
Yeah.
It was a small black and white, but it had incredible resolution. The monitor itself, the quality of the screen was really a good monitor.
It was beautiful, but don't forget, to boot up this computer, there was no hard drive. We used a 3.5-inch floppy disk, which was new back then,
yes.
innovative. You booted up, and then you ejected that disk, and then you put it in
because everything got loaded into
right.
ROM then.
Yeah, because there wasn't enough RAM back then to run it all.
Yeah, and they were 128K was the first Mac. Now, but that fairly quickly changed. The Fat Mac was launched, which was
512K. That was the one I was using when I joined in October in 84.
Yeah, by the end of the year.
By then, it was Fat Mac was kind of the standard. At
yes.
And that's what we called it, Fat Mac, 512.
And the other app was Mac Write, which was a right. word processor.
Right.
Now, this was before Windows, Microsoft Windows was released, so the other computers were running, as you said, CPM or DOS. So it was a huge departure from these other systems, but
right.
not as big a departure from Apple's previous operating system, which was a very premium one that people don't remember an awful lot, which was Apple's Lisa product,
right.
which was a... It looked a little bit like a Mac that had been squashed sideways. It was right. a big, big, long thing with a monitor on one side. But the Lisa was unbelievable.
It was about $10,000.
It was $10,600, and it was about 80 pounds.
Yeah.
And to do a Lisa demo, I still remember Ken Fordham years ago telling me, doing a demo with Lisa, Ian, you need some help. You're going to have to send two people, because to get it out of the trunk of the car and into someone's office to show them the Lisa, you'd put your back out. It was such a heavy, big brute.
And this has been kind of lost, to the current generation, but it was legendary amongst us, we all thought that Jobs and the team, the original Apple team, were the people that really created the mouse, which was the mouse and the pointing system with a button to click, which is so second nature to us today, so that children seemingly out of the womb know how to do it. That was spectacularly new, but it wasn't an Apple invention.
No, it was Xerox.
Xerox at Xerox Park.
Yeah.
Palo Alto Research Corporation. Xerox had a desktop, or not desktop, but they had a publishing system called the Star Publisher,
right?
And it's Xerox Star, which newspapers and magazines were starting to buy to do their typesetting. And they interfaced with high-end systems. And this is Kevin in my background, is the desktop publishing systems with Linotype and these sorts of people. But it was designed to interface with those systems. And Jobs had done a tour, seen the mouse, and just brazenly stole the idea.
Jobs and Woz, the two Steves. And in fact, the woman that ran the Palo Alto Research Center briefing center did not want to give the two Steves a tour because they knew about, they were in the valley, in Silicon Valley, and she had heard what these two Steves were doing. They were going to change the world. And the people of Xerox in New York were too busy printing money, selling toner to the world, that this little star system, the mouse.
It didn't register.
No, it was skunkworks.
Somebody's going to have to help me out here. Was John Warnock at Xerox at the time as well? Or he was pitching PostScript to them, I think, possibly. That was the idea.
Yeah, that might have been it.
Yeah, because the or his wife worked there. I can't remember what this whole story was. But there was a third player in that game, because while we celebrate the success of the Mac and we talk about it, there was a lot of complementary products that really played heavily into
PostScript and then an output device, a printer.
What was that great desktop publishing software package? And someone reminded me just yesterday of the name of it. With the letter Q.
Quark Express.
Quark Express. Do you remember that?
Well, yeah, because that was my
amazing.
Program. That's the program
exactly.
that I built myself on.
And do you remember a desktop publishing workstation with printer, software, training?
Oh.
You were in the 15 to 20K range, right?
Yes. Let's talk. Now, I started a few years after you guys. I came in late 1986. So I was 2 years later. The Macintosh SE was just launched. So that was the product of choice. And we were selling it, I think, for $5,200.
Right.
And I think cost was around $4,100 or $4,000. We used to get 35 points of margin. That's what we aimed for.
You would aim for
35 points in margin, and we'd trim a little bit here and there, but that was what we would go. I mean,
today the margins are probably 3-4%,
if that. You know? Yeah, it's just been hammered down to absolute nothing in the margins. But let's just take those numbers: $5,000 for a computer that ran 8 megahertz was the speed of the computer. We've all got watches more powerful than this computer. All of our smartphones blow it out of the water. 8 megahertz. It had a 20 megabyte internal hard drive and an 800K floppy. And then they came out with the Macintosh SE 30 FD HD, which had the 1.2 megabyte floppy disk, I think, right?
Right.
Oh boy, I'm really having to work the memory now. But in that, at $5,000, what could, if you had $5,000 today, lay down on a computer system, what could you get?
Well, it's probably $8,000.
Well, I was just about to do that. Let's do the math. Yeah. Let's convert that into today dollars. I mean, houses in Vancouver then were $80,000.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd buy yourself a really nice server now. You wouldn't, with that kind of money.
More than that.
I mean, farm.
You'd buy yourself your computer, your notebook, and a trip to Mexico for the family.
And get your teeth
and
done.
Car.
You know?
Yeah, get veneers.
You know, Steve, what was also interesting is we considered these portable computers.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And it was 12
It came
12
with
pounds?
A case. It came with a, do you remember the
Mac
case?
Sack. The green sack. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, and there were lots of local, in the BC area, in the Vancouver area. Remember Willow Design? There was a guy, crazy guy, because he was getting progressively more bizarre every time he visited us in the store, because he was gluing all of his, he had this Cordera, this nylon, and he would be gluing the seams on these things. I'm sure that the fumes from the glue was affected. And when he started showing up originally selling us his bags, he was kind of a normal looking guy, and then he started to look more and more like the professor from Back to Future as time went by. But he would always
sack you're talking about, though, it sold. You're talking about Macs and the price and the day and age. That we Apple had a program that we ran. It was called Test Drive a Mac program.
Yeah,
you guys both know it. Remember it really well, right? And so the idea was, the premise was the puppy dog clothes. You take the puppy home for the weekend. You feed it. Take out the litter. By then you love it. You've named it. It's sleeping on your bed. Same thing with a Mac. You take a Mac home for the weekend in the knapsack, that Mac sack.
Yeah.
You bring it back Monday to your dealer of choice, and I dare you to give it back to us.
Yeah, yeah.
By then we'll take a check instead. Thank you very much. Who's next?
It was a pretty innovative program that nobody else had done, the test drive. And if you're an employee, even at a retail store, you could purchase the Mac for something like $500 or $700. And so they got it in the hands of as many people.
That was our McDonald's marketing strategy, is to make it viral. I think before there was social media, Apple still did something with that.
Yeah.
Who sold Macs? The day you demoed it for me, Kevin, the first time, I saw the passion coming out of your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, wow, I don't know anyone who runs around with a Windows computer and says, I'm changing the world. Look what this thing can do.
Right.
It doesn't happen. With the Mac and those days, it happened everywhere. Whoever the user, the customer was part of Steve Jobs' sales force.
Yeah.
That absolutely was true.
And it was religion. It was religion.
That was it.
And
it's a badge of rebellion. A Mac is a badge of rebellion. You're changing
Mac?
The world. You're going against the grain. You're doing it differently. When I met Steve in 84 in Hawaii for the first time at a sales conference, my God, I was a 25-year-old sales guy with a tie on. Steve had a t-shirt on and jeans and suspenders. And I turned into an 8-year-old groupie. I had to go up and talk to him at the pool.
Yeah.
He was amazing. The guy walked on water.
Yeah.
He did change the world. And it's still on. Just because he's passed, the poor man, his vision, his passion lives in all of us who touched one of his products.
Well,
I believe that.
This is what we need to get to is how we each built careers, and how so many of our friends and coworkers built careers around the tinder that started the fire being the Mac. Now, we didn't all stay right with that, but that passion for industry, that passion for business, that passion for growth, that passion for engagement, that was born out of those days of empowerment that we learned from the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us carried on that are successful. And, you know, I sent out an invitation for this show. Everybody's still really busy. I think about 8 or 9 people that were all there at the beginning, every one of them successful, like way beyond our education. Like, what education do we have, Kev?
Next question.
BCIT.
Next question.
But beyond our education, beyond our station.
About our criminal track records.
Yeah, yeah. But beyond our station, because we were there, because when we started with the Mac, and I've said this over and over again, it didn't matter what you knew, it mattered what you could learn. And it was how open we were, how open a vessel we were to new ideas, to new concepts, to taking something and running with it and asking for permission before, asking for forgiveness instead of permission. Absolutely. Just kind of, you know, yeah, it'll do this. And right. then we'd figure out how to do it.
Right.
And but that really jump-started so many careers. And that's going to be the topic we're going to talk about in a minute, is what it meant to us personally as we grow, because we should take a break. Right, Art? We're going to take a break. Okay, we'll take a break. I've got Ian Selby. I've got Kevin Jampol. I've got Macworld version 1 with Steve Jobs leering at me over top of three 128K Macs here today on Dottotech.
Do you have a Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs.
Visit our website.
Nobody does
at
dottotech.com and
you.
Click on Contact Us. Dottotech is brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. Now, back to Steve.
We're sitting in the Dottotech Wayback Machine today, taking a look at 30 years ago, the birth of the Mac, and three of the, children of the Mac are here in the studio. Well, three of us. Ian Selby is with me, Kevin Jampol, and of course, I'm Steve Dotto. And all of us began in the mid-80s in the computer business, or continue our career, but the Mac found itself front and center of all of our lives. And so, Kev, you and I actually followed a really close career path for a few years, because we competed against each other for the longest time. And John Cade, remember?
Yeah.
He used to work with you, and I can't remember. There was a few other guys that were selling desktop publishing. But we jumped on one of the bandwagons very early on, which was the Macintosh proved to be an exceptional desktop publishing tool. And it was in the days when it couldn't get in the front door in corporations, it was the way to get in the back. And back in the day, before we started selling Macs to the community, and I'll take a lot of response credit for the change in the publishing industry, of course, but people had to buy dedicated typesetters. And that's if right. you ever worked in a print shop, and I actually did work in print shops and repaired printing presses actually for a while, the bottleneck in every print shop was the typesetter. And everybody was afraid of the typesetter because they did some weird voodoo stuff in a closed room. They were part photographer because they were developing film, doing photo typesetting. This was after the days of lead type, but they were actually basically exposing film with the images of the letters in order to create printing press plates, which would ultimately be printed. And it was a chemical intensive, labor intensive process that took a lot of training. And then out of the box, all of a sudden, Ian mentioned Quark Express and Aldus PageMaker, and there were these applications where you could just type and then select the text. And again, everybody at home is going to go, this is so everyday, but it was magic. The first time that you could select type and you could make a drop cap. Remember just making it one letter bigger so that it dropped down one line and introduced a paragraph. People were blown away. When we could adjust the font, of course, the size, but then once we started to have the control to adjust the leading and the kerning between the between the lines of type or between the letters. That was just, it was mind-blowing,
you know,
to us.
Just to interrupt there, from what I remember, Steve, after I worked at Byte Shop, I went and worked for Aldus, which is a company that coined the term desktop publishing and then merged with Adobe. I remember I was out in Winnipeg and I was doing a presentation about 40 strippers, they were called, and people worked in service bureaus who did the printing.
Oh, those strippers.
I beg your pardon. Those kind of strippers. And then I snapped.
That's another conversation. Yeah. And there were union shops back then. And I remember I was demonstrating what we could do with WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get. And these guys looked like they had fear in their eyes, but they were so angry that a young software dude like me at 26 years old, 27 years old would come and say that computers were going to take over their jobs if they didn't adapt to it.
There was real resentment.
And use it as a tool. There sure was. And that, you know, people were upset that we were putting publishing tools in the hands of the average user. Yeah. Now everybody could create in their minds ugly documents.
That's it.
And you know, this story that was about to play, the narrative that started with us showing desktop publishing to publishing professionals, has been now reenacted several times over as we look at other medias.
Absolutely.
That the Mac especially has impacted, as we talk about audio and podcasting and radio, and now we're talking the same narrative in video.
Yep.
With YouTube, and that changing the whole broadcast world and spectrum is how can the great unwashed, people that aren't trained, possibly produce as good a content as us, who it is our stock in trade. And while we don't produce as good at content, it's Tim Ferriss's minimum effective dose. It's good enough.
Right.
And although we didn't kind of carry that flag of it being it's good enough, that was what carried us
right.
through each right. each sales cycle was
yeah.
yes, the type wasn't quite as good as you could get from a dedicated photo typesetter with all of the bells and whistles. But the average user couldn't tell the difference. Yeah, the average
right.
reader couldn't tell the difference.
Right.
The average publisher couldn't tell the difference. It was only those trained in the art of typesetting that could tell the difference, and they were being nitpicky.
That's where right. the resistance probably
oh,
also
it did.
Came
well,
from.
Well, and
right?
also, yeah. I mean, do you remember how ugly some publication people? I mean, people it looked like ransom notes because they'd use
yeah.
every
oh.
font.
You know, oh my God!
We've got 27 fonts. We're going to use them all on this page.
Everyone became a designer.
Oh
and
yeah!
Everyone's got a blog today. Back then, everyone had a newsletter.
Yeah,
and the paperless office? Are you kidding me? We chopped down more trees because of desktop publishing than anything before.
Oh.
It was amazing. Everyone was printing it in 15 versions because you had to get it just right.
And
then WYSIWYG, right?
Yeah.
What you see is what you get. It, with a Mac, it actually was true.
Yes.
Whatever you put on the screen looked like it on paper.
And mm-hmm. we were enthralled by this world of black and white.
Yeah.
We hadn't even introduced color.
Right.
And it wasn't till the Mac oh. 2.
Yeah.
Yeah,
with
8-bit
color, which yeah. was in 1987, late 1987, that color was even introduced as an afterthought. And we certainly didn't have any printers.
And then the color
right.
laser
so,
printers.
But, I mean, just so everybody understands, back in those days, you couldn't just take a – there were no Apple printers at that time. You needed a special kit and cable. GDT, InfoWave used to sell those.
Yeah.
So they were like $100, $125 and to connect your PC printer to your Macintosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Apple released the LaserWriter, which really
right.
marked the beginning of the desktop publishing revolution because now you could proof your pages.
Right.
And we took off. But those, how much were they, Dean?
Oh, the laser printers?
$7,500?
Oh, look, I remember selling them to BC Hydro. A workstation with the government discount was around $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think retail was up around $5,000, a Mac 2 CX.
Yeah.
And then the laser printer just broke the 10K barrier. I think we got them into, you know, $9,000.
Yeah.
Range for the laser printer, and they were buying truckloads. So expensive in the day. And what you can get now, it's insane.
Is this why Apple could afford those great parties they used to have down in
oh,
California?
The parties, Kevin, and you'll remember them. Like
oh,
some
I
of
sure
us at the sales conferences, they'd fly in the Pointer Sisters or Jefferson Starship
the money
for a private party, just for a private party.
Well, when you're getting 35 points of margin, and Apple was making more than that on the hardware, the retailers were making 35.
There was
points.
Company yeah, right. culture, and then there was cult. Apple was a cult.
Yeah.
I've been in other companies and had my own sense, and I can tell you what Apple had going on for culture, the money it invested in people. Talk about the Mac being a framework or a fabric to learn into and drive a career. The company Apple itself resonated that as well.
Yeah.
They would invest in their people like no one I've ever seen.
And that was you when you I don't know if you still have it on your resume, but you said you went to the University of Apple because of all the training, all the courses that they put you on over
totally,
the years.
Totally right. The amount of training, whether you want it or not, but presentation skills, sales training, leadership training, and then the product training, the amount of product training that, again, a lot of these things, just it's hard to put those into corporate budgets these days.
Mm-hmm.
But do you remember the Apple Store?
Oh, yeah.
It was a big deal if you could fly down to California and get inside the Apple
on
Store.
On Infinity Boulevard in Cupertino.
Yeah.
Toys and gadgets.
The Apple swag. And not like, I mean, you look at all the accomplishments Apple's made. The PC with the Mac, the iPod, the iTunes, the iPhone, the iPad, even the revolutionizing retail, the way an Apple store looks like today. This isn't that kind of store. This was sort of employees only, or you brought your customers down and you buy an Apple with the colored logo windsurfer. Do you remember that in the Apple store?
Oh, I have a cheese board at home.
and the logo where? Every product, every show, there was T-shirts.
Oh,
and it was just, it was a culture. Everybody was walking around with they're wearing their Apple gear
good
all the
stuff.
Time.
It was like sweatshirts and letter jackets. Still
last.
Jackets.
Oh, yeah.
Like the amount of, before Apple would invent a product, before they'd put any money in, it's print the shirts.
Yeah.
Print, go ahead, get the shirts ready, and then recruit the team you need with the search.
Yeah.
You know, okay, we're going to build this great new product. Here's the shirt for it. Oh, it's a cool shirt. Yeah, I'll join you.
Yeah.
That was the type of internal project that were going on in the day at Apple.
And,
it's true.
And again, to everybody that's kind of listening today, we didn't have the internet.
Oh, gotcha.
There was no way of disseminating all of this exciting information. And all through Silicon Valley, all around the world, developers were coming up with new products and new ideas and new ways. And I very quickly left the desktop publishing world. Kevin left, kind of got deeper in. You went to Aldis. I went to a distributor and started to concentrate my efforts on multimedia, on video and animation. And it was really early, really, really early days for that.
You have to add humor, Steve. When you're talking about yourself and the career path you've taken, I would have to stop you full stop and say, Steve, you got to add humor there. You're one of the funniest men I know.
Well, thank you, Selbs. That's the T-shirt's in the mail. where was I going with that? Oh, there was – so the culture of learning and how we shared and how we figured out things, I can remember waiting – with bated breath for the magazine delivery truck to arrive at the store we worked at with the newest issues of Mac User and Mac World magazine. And then I would literally devour them cover to cover, including reading every ad and rereading it and rereading every ad, trying to figure out exactly what these products did.
Right.
And that was the way we learned. And then we would go to the trade shows. And the trade shows were absolutely so important in developing the knowledge base of the community, of the sales community. So we would have every January a Macworld in San Francisco, and every August we would have Macworld in Boston. And so we would go on these sojourns down to these shows and just gear up. And I don't know if you ever worked hard at the show as far as you would work in the Boosie, but you probably ended up working more in the Boosie.
Yeah, I did both.
But we would just gear up, get our bags, and start collecting brochures.
Because that's the only way we knew how to source or find products to sell back in Vancouver.
Yeah, because there was no way to search for these things online. So you'd be taking phone numbers, business cards. There was nothing like that. And so you'd just go down and just gather. And then began a chase, because you would find a cool product. And then you say, who's your distributor in Canada? Well, they didn't have a distributor in Canada. Right. So could you buy direct? No, we're not selling direct. We're not set up for that. And so all of a sudden this tap dance to try and figure out how to get that product into your store.
Across the border.
Yeah, across the border. And we would be talking about software that was selling for minimum of $195. Can you think of any software that sold less?
PageMaker was $800.
$800
Quark was about $1,000.
Quark was $995.
Even more.
Yeah, Quark was $995. When we were selling Macromine Director, the multimedia package, that was $695. Yeah. $695, folks. We're not talking an app at $6.95, which is an unbelievably expensive app today. We're talking $695, $1988.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And people were
and they were lining up to buy it.
Yeah, and it was all to produce something on a printer. It wasn't to publish something to the web to hundreds of thousands and millions of people.
Right.
It was to publish to a printer, to a magazine, to a newsletter, to a newspaper, to a proposal.
Right.
It was all of that was focused on that level of communication. Staggering.
Yeah, absolutely. The proposal, the design that came out.
Oh, the amount of effort that we put in.
Amazing proposals that would come out after desktop publishing had hit.
Oh, yeah.
It went from the most boringest document that you could think of to, oh, my gosh, look at the work of art. People would win deals just because of the look of the proposal.
Yeah.
And then they'd win. Oh, no, we have to deliver. What are we going to do now?
But returning to the trade shows for a moment, I can still remember that we would go around, and it was after my second or third one, and it might have been the cause at Advantage Computers that tagged me onto this, is we started, instead of bringing the brochures back, we started shipping the brochures back. We'd get a shipping box at the hotel. We would pack them up, and then we'd get UPS to ship the brochures, because there was so many, they were so heavy, that they would be shipped back rather than carry them in our luggage on the airlines.
Yeah.
And of course there was the booth bimbos. That was a whole different trade. There was the booths would have attractive women that would be there and know nothing about the product, just to attract people by.
Well, we did our best to train them, but we didn't have much time either.
It is amazing how much it's evolved, the selling of computers, how retail works today as it did back then. Because when you were at Advantage and Byte and Infomax, the major dealers in town, they were independent dealers. And now it's the chains, right?
Yes.
That are kind of running the show. And the margins are slim, and the training and that they get, I assume, is pretty minimal. It's turned into a commodity. But the software hasn't, right? So people are still recognizes some value at some level in the software. But it's a software they're learning. They don't need to learn the hardware anymore. Mm-hmm.
when I think back and I recognize the passion that we all had and I look at the skills and the people that came out of the Mac, IBM had to have been an unbelievably potent force in business for Windows and for the Windows operating system and DOS before that, but the IBM culture for their computers to have dominated so much and put the Mac actually on the brink of extinction for many years because of its acceptance into business. The mind share that IBM must have had back in those days must have been just massive.
It was the war. It was Apple versus IBM. And I remember, you know, the term IBM, we used it for many different things.
Yeah.
The old saying, if you bought IBM, you'd never get fired.
Yeah.
And we used to try and turn it and say, but would you get promoted? And what IBM really stood for is I bought Macintosh. And we'd get into it, but they were the war. That was the war. Before the war was pointed towards Microsoft at Apple, it was against IBM.
Yeah.
My first sales conference in 84 at Hawaii that I was talking about earlier, the theme of the conference, and every year the conference had a theme. The theme that year was Blue Busters, because the movie of the year, some of you weren't alive yet, was Ghostbusters. And they had the Buster sign, the no sign, and they had a silhouette of an IBM salesperson with a tie, short hair, and a briefcase and a Buster sign over it. And so the focus, the enemy was clearly IBM. And they were leveraging their mainframe experience and dominance in corporate to get the desktop. Well, Apple was good in education and trying to become a business player as well.
Apple run an ad back then that was famous, Welcome IBM, seriously?
Yes, absolutely. Apple had a party in 81 when the PC was announced.
Yeah.
It was great. It's like three gas stations on a corner are all going to sell more gas than someone who owns their own corner somewhere else. So the idea validated the industry.
And Jobs did a famous interview where he talked about how it legitimized the industry. And I know we're late for break, but I want to stay on this theme for a second here, because the battle for the battle of advertising then was fascinating because we didn't have the internet to form public opinion. It was all about the ads. And IBM very quickly came out with two directions of their ads. And I hope I'm not missing something, but there was the iconic Charlie Chaplin ads that they had, which were very just designed to be engaging. And then there was the IBM Blue ads, the ones where they showed IBM reps, and all the IBM ad would be some guy, you would never see his face, I think, but you'd see him, you'd see the white press shirt being buttoned, the black tie being tightened. You'd see the closet door would be open, and there would be suit after suit after suit that was identical. Onto the wingtip shoes, which there was like seven pairs, all identical, all polished, just boom. And it was all about being dressed for business and being. And if you set that against Apple's ads, which were at that same time, which was think different.
Totally.
Right? And it was the thinkers, the philosophers, the musicians, the poets.
If you can point, you can do this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, that's where the Aurelian ad came from that you started the show with in 1984. And then just, you can either follow, there was a Lemming ad, I'm sorry.
The Lemming ad. Falling off the cliff.
People were falling off the cliff.
Yes,
that was classic.
Stark. we're gonna continue with more of this Mac retrospective. 30 years of the Mac. I have Ian Selby in studio. I have Kevin Jampol. I'm Steve Dotto, and you're tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Except nobody does it better. Except maybe you.
To the future.
We're back to the future. 1984. We set the numbers on the DeLorean to January 5th, 1984, and we could have watched the Super Bowl again. It'd be good to be able to bet on that Super Bowl, and then
buy shares in Apple.
Yeah, and watch the ad of that incredibly hot Scandinavian woman running up to the screen with that sledgehammer, and then peeling around, and then tossing it. What's upsetting? It's upsetting to know she's probably 65 years old right now.
If Mac's 30, we're pretty old right now.
Yeah, I know. I tell you.
You know what? I got shivers down my back when I watch, and still do when I see that commercial.
Oh, absolutely. It's still considered marketing and advertising, who are an industry unto themselves. Mm-hmm. Steve, you would know this. You touched it a lot. But they still call that ad the best ever ad that ever ran in the history of advertising.
Yeah.
Really?
The ad. It got nothing to do with the product. It's the ad. It's like held up as the thing.
That is just one of the mercurial moments in Steve Jobs' life.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because, I mean, for, you know, we a year ago, we did a show, which you joined me on, and that talked about Steve Jobs, the man, and what he meant to the world and how he changed the world. But to have had the confidence and the vision to say, to make those claims... Mm-hmm. It's just, it's staggering.
Oh, his amazing. I don't know anyone else, not firsthand or otherwise, like Steve.
Yeah.
When he had his vision locked on something and his ability to enlist an army to help him actualize it, that was special.
Art's running the video for us right now. There she is in her red shorts running forward. There she is. Spin. And the launch of the hammer.
Goosebumps. Goosebumps.
Yeah. And then all of the guys who look so much like prisoners of war.
Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Ooh.
And they just put up that seven color logo. The logo, which, as Kevin knows, as a desktop publishing guy, almost bankrupt Apple because Jobs' insistence on purity, you had to use Pantone colors. So a printing press in those days was a four-color process where you had four different colors that were mixed together through what's called a process with different dots being laid down to create colors. Jobs would not let people use a four-color process to print the logo on any official Apple gear. So every piece of Apple paraphernalia that went through the printing press had to go through twice to lay down the seven colors because there was no seven-color printing presses. They were all four. Maybe you could get a five-color printing press occasionally, but it would still have to go through twice. So you had an incredibly challenging printing process in doing it till they finally changed the logo to the monochrome logo.
If it wasn't perfect, it wasn't happening.
Well, there's also a famous story about a packaging issue where Jobs was also... And these are things, again, that are second nature today. But the out-of-box experience. Remember how Apple would talk about your first exposure to a product had to be spectacular and had to be delightful. And so opening the Macintosh box, there was a process that you go through and a journey that you were taken through from the first README file to the first piece of hardware that you presented
guided
with.
Guided tour.
Yeah, the guided tours and all that. And something was put in a box wrong in Asia, and they sent back an entire SKU of product had to be sent back and repackaged, like $1 million.
Perfectionism, though. It's all about that. That's what he was about. That's what
Ian, did you meet any of the, I mean, we're talking about Steve Jobs and you know, a master at marketing, creative, but there's also the people behind the scenes. I'm looking at a mouse here, one of the original Apple mouse that I had autographed by Steve Wozniak, signed as Woz, and Andy Hertzfeld, original designers. They were up in Vancouver, and I mean, these guys did an incredible job.
That's worth $1 million on eBay. You know that.
But
you
know, Woz's
signature on that thing.
But you know, these guys. I know there was just a reunion for the original Apple team down in California. But it's the guys behind the scenes, and they're autographs. The original designers all autographed the inside.
Wow.
Of that first Mac.
The casing.
There was four photos of the original designers embedded as an Easter egg in the ROM of the original Mac of the original Mac. Seven or nine people designed it. It was a tiny team.
It's like the movie Jobs, that actual movie of his life, which is fairly recent. It depicts it very well. Kevin and I talked about this. It's great. I actually met Woz, but it was after we were both left Apple. Apple in Cupertino had a reunion. So I went down and hooked up with our old friend Ian Adam. We went out and played golf and had a couple of lollipops and then went over to the Apple reunion. And Steve Jobs didn't come because Scully was there.
Right.
And after the fallout, you wouldn't get, in, let alone the same room, the same building, if Scully was there, Jobs wouldn't go and vice versa. There was a really bad falling out there. But I did get to meet Woz as well.
Yeah, interesting.
And that was another fascinating part of the whole narrative is the fact that Jobs, who along with Steve Wozniak, but certainly Jobs as the leader, as the bully, as the visionary, after the company had grown and the Mac Plus had been out, and now we reached the point where the laser printer was out. They'd released the SE, and they released the first color Macintosh. And now their board of directors felt that Steve Jobs, probably at the age then of 26, 27, not very old, maybe 28.
No, Jobs was 28 when I joined in 84, so add 5.
33.
Yeah, 33.
But still
young,
really
young man.
By today's standards, he still hasn't left home.
Yeah. Stop feeding them cheese.
You know? but the board of directors felt they needed some more senior leadership, so they started to look to America's major brands to find a new leader, to find somebody to take That's them right. to the next level. And it was really designed to compete with IBM at that point and ultimately to Microsoft. Yeah. But to move them to that stage. And there was the fascinating courtship with John Sculley, who, if you think about it today, is about as bad a fit for technology company as you could ask. John Sculley was trained by Pepsi.
Right.
Yeah.
But he understood corporate America. He understood the stock market. He understood those things. So all of a sudden, this technology company that had had a visionary leader was now courting John Sculley. And Sculley said no.
Well, the recruiting story on its own.
Oh, the New York story. Is that what you're?
Yeah.
Was that in the movie? Was that in the movie?
It was in the movie as well.
Was the line?
The line. So they're on the phone. Sculley has turned Jobs down.
They were standing in Central Park. He turned him down, and Jobs was about to get into the cab.
Yeah. Jobs turns around and says, "John, do you want to sell sugar water to children for the rest of your life, or come with me and change the world?"
And then he got in the cab.
Goosebumps. Got in the van. And then that was
done. And Sculley talks in his book about that was what changed his mind.
That's what changed his mind, but it also changed Apple's culture and nearly bankrupted the company.
But it also probably in the seeds of that near destruction sowed the seeds for the success the return of the prodigal son.
Oh, sure. The iron sharpened iron, and what Steve did next and then came back.
Yeah.
He came back on a bigger mission than he was ever on before.
But don't forget, Apple was still in some niche markets. Education.
Oh, big niche.
Desktop publishing, as you and I were talking about.
Yeah.
So they were looking to bring in some heavy hitters to try to, help them move into the corporate enterprise world.
And it worked to some degree, but it really changed the culture so much that a lot of the good people started to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it's not just the leader. It's who the leader surrounds himself with, and Steve did a wonderful job of that. Yeah.
And there are so many little sidebar stories that are so fascinating in those early days. I mean, we've talked about desktop publishing. We've talked about that whole space, which was the place that we played in. But let's not forget that the original Mac success and the original Apple success, dating back to the Apple II, was because of a spreadsheet called VisiCalc.
That's it. Right. That's
visual calculator.
The visual calculator. And talk about lost opportunity. When I think about people who just missed by that much, it's the two guys that invented VisiCalc because they didn't patent the spreadsheet.
Yes, and along
which
came
was so
everyone
patentable.
Else. Microsoft, Lotus.
Excel.
Soon after that, Lotus, Microsoft, Wings,
Informix.
Informix. But Microsoft with Excel, head-to-head with Lotus for the longest time. But that was what drove in those products, all not following the Apple, not following onto the Mac with the spreadsheet early on, but instead going into the Windows world, into the MS-DOS world, ultimately Windows, gave such a foothold in financial America.
Yes.
That was why Apple was playing catch up for the rest until today. When
first in wins biggest, and they become the early standard. And that's really
bad. But they were the only ones that could click and drag through cells like you do today.
And Bill Wright and all the cool features.
Those were exciting days, even playing with VisiCalc.
Oh, and, the first time you used a spreadsheet, you went, what?
Didn't sleep. Mm-hmm. It was like finding the internet.
And the magic. You know, this is. Yeah. You know, we've returned to this a couple of times today, but the magic. The joy of discovery, the sheer fun of clicking on something, highlighting it, changing the font. It is so pedestrian today.
Yeah.
But you have no idea what it was like discover it for the first time.
And to have others discover it.
Show it to people.
I loved showing it. Okay, you try it. Instead of demoing the Mac, my favorite thing was to get them to try it themselves.
Yeah.
Put your hand on the mouse. And people at first didn't realize they could pick it up.
Yeah.
And they were like 4 feet over on their desk.
I can remember the first. Do you remember going to the Apple training room and watching the trainers? People like Alice Matheson.
Oh, yeah.
And Sean Pruden, the different trainers that we had here in Vancouver. And you guys had the most expensive real estate in Vancouver back in the day.
Park Place.
Yeah, Park Place. Yeah. And there was this training room in there that people would sit down and they would learn things. And here was the thing. It would take the trainers at Apple a day to set up to do a training because they had to go through each and every computer, clean off the previous stuff, do a fresh install of the operating system, and you do it using a phenomenal technology called SneakerNet.
Yes.
Which was basically going with a floppy disk from machine to machine, one at a time.
No cloud, no internet, no nothing.
And then, even before the internet, when the SE30 was released, we suddenly got the very first kind of networking standard that we all experienced, which was AppleTalk.
Yes.
And where there was this funny little box that we could plug into the back of the Mac that would allow multiple Macs to share the same printer, and ultimately multiple Macs to do a little bit of file sharing back and forth.
The first mail program. I remember Steve Jobs at a conference demoing it to all of us people worldwide at the sales, and it was mail. It was Apple's first mail program, and he had two screens up on the large screens, and both were screens of Macs. He'd send the mail, and it looked like an actual letter with the blue and red around the edges, and it would leave one Mac screen and appear on the other. Now, how elementary is that? That got a standing ovation.
Yeah.
That was like we had just invented the world. It was amazing.
And it's this cauldron of change, of excitement that for all of us, I mean, you know, the purpose of today's show was to reminisce, to tell our listeners a little bit about the excitement and what it was like back in the day, but also to discuss how each of us launched our careers based on this. So I just want to take a step back now. We've only got a few minutes left. But Kevin, so you left, you finished selling Apples. And take me on your career path and tell me what you think the Mac meant.
Yeah, so I stayed till the late 80s in retail. I just loved, you know, changing people's lives. And then I loved the desktop publishing side. So I went to Aldus, which then became Adobe. And I've worked for large companies and I've worked for smaller companies. I've stayed in technology all this time. I just love the pace. I love the change. I love the creativity. I love the intelligence and the smart people in this industry. It's fun.
When you look at things to do
My house is outfitted with Apple equipment everywhere.
When you look at things to do that are not in technology, does it excite you as much as the technology world?
Oh, no. Never. Not at all. It's hard to duplicate. And I'm sure my kids have that same feeling. They grew up with Mac and Apple, and they continue to love it just as much as I do.
And Ian, you were with Apple for how long?
10 years.
10 years.
84 to 94.
Yeah.
1990 was a significant year for me. But you're right. Apple, it's in the DNA. It ends up being in your blood system.
Yeah.
And you know, I've long
said... I
always
say, you cut us and we bleed seven colors.
You can take the boy out of Apple. You can't take Apple out of the boy. And I think that could be said about all three of us in the room and many others who experienced similar things. And I launched a company at the time called Power Marketing because in the mid-90s, early 90s at Apple, we had the Power PC chip.
Mm-hmm.
So we were Power everything. It was Power, Power, Power. So I grabbed the name Power Marketing to launch my sales training and consulting business, which, again, I tried to replicate in building that business through the last 17 years. I tried to replicate just a little piece of the culture that Apple shared so generously with so many of us.
Yeah, and for me as well, you know, it was that culture, it was that level of excitement, it was that level of engagement that led me into media, and always with my team, I always tried to bring that energy, and that to me was the joy of discovery. And for my TV shows, for our radio show, it's always about finding something cool, finding something interesting, finding something that makes you feel, I didn't know I could do that. I'd like to be able to do that, that's still here.
So with the pace of change today, we're not going to wait 30 more years to have this reunion.
No, we'll do it. We'll do it every year. We'll do it once a month, maybe once a month. And that is all the time. I need to thank you guys very much. Ian Selby, Kevin Jampol, Art, thanks for kicking in with so many good stories from back in the day. That is all the time we have for this week's show. If you're interested in finding out more, we'll have some links on the site. We'll have some photos, and I found some great resources on Wikipedia of stuff back in the day, and I even took a picture of Kevin's Macworld version 1. And do you want this back, Kevin?
Yeah, I think I do.
I think you do. Thanks so much for coming in, guys. It's been a fun 30 years,
That's
hasn't
been
it?
Great fun. Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Happy birthday.
To 30 more. I'm Steve Dotto, and you're tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.